Welcome to another episode of the We Have a Meeting podcast. So today we are incredibly lucky. We often talk about sales. We often talk a lot about different salespeople and having to wear different hats. One of those hats is being the lawyer. So I feel very lucky today as we're joined by a real life barrister, and not just any barrister, but one of the best in the country. Today's guest has been consistently ranked as one of the top planning barristers nationally. And in 2022, they were ranked as the best planning barrister under the age of 35. Our guest today is a specialist planning barrister for the King's Chamber. It's Killian Garvey. Killian, how are you?
Really good. Thanks, Jack. Thanks for the introduction.
No worries. A lot of accolades there. So, Killian, we start our podcast the same way every single time. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
So, I am a planning barrister at King's Chambers. The problem I solve is representing clients, typically who are trying to get planning permission for large-scale housing schemes. That's a lot of my work's involved in that. And my job is to convince a decision maker that they should have planning permission. And so the problem of my job is advising clients and articulating their arguments to try and persuade someone.
Okay. And then if we take you back many years before you were a fully fledged barrister, why law? What was it that got you into law, and what set you off on that path?
Really good question. I wanted to do a few jobs. I wanted to either be a musician, a film director, or a barrister. And it wasn't just law, it was being a barrister, because you're self-employed and you employ a range of skills in terms of advocacy. So there's a live element, there's an element of performance there. And in the week I got offered the job to be a barrister, I also got asked to be a film producer on a project. So I had the two right in front of me, and I thought the barrister one was the one for me. I was quite good in school, or at least I worked hard at it, and the bar gave me that opportunity to sort of test that side of me.
Killian, you talked before about, it jumped out to me straight away, about persuading decision makers, which is obviously something that we think of when it comes to selling and sales. When you look at your job and sales, often the similarities perhaps aren't clear. You're a well-educated man. We're scumbags. But when you look at the landscape of both jobs, what similarities do you see?
To my mind, the essential skill of persuading is the same. Whether I'm trying to convince a judge of something or whether you're trying to sell a product, I imagine. To my mind, there are three essential ingredients. First is know your audience and tailor accordingly. Second is have something good to sell. And three is cut out your bad points. You'll presumably have seen the film Wolf of Wall Street, which is all about the life of Jordan Belfort. And he asked in the film, they asked the question, sell me this pen. And it's testing, how do you sell an item? Now, the real man, Jordan Belfort, I've seen an interview with him where he was asked, what's the ideal answer? And he says, well, it's normally you ask them, how long have you been in the market for a pen? And it's that you want to, before you sell anything to anyone, you've got to know who you're selling to. And I think that's true in law and probably in sales. So I've got to cater for the person I'm trying to persuade. I've got to kind of think, well, what will they know? What will they not know? What's their inclination? And I will cater my argument to specific judges. I will take a case a certain direction with one judge and not with another. Having a good case, I imagine in sales, if you've got a good product, it makes it a lot easier to sell it. Same with law. If I've got a good case, that's really important. And cutting out of bad points. If your agenda is to try and fool people and con people and trying to oversell something, you'll normally always get found out. And that's, again, true in law, and I imagine it's true in sales. So it's just cut out your bad points and be as sincere as possible to sell something going out on an authentic basis.
And there seems to be two schools of thought. There seems to be, I can persuade someone. I'm charismatic, well-educated, well-spoken. I can persuade anyone. I've got the gift of the gab. And then there's another school of thought that I have to take someone down a journey where they persuade themselves. Which do you subscribe to?
That is a really, really deep and interesting question. I could probably spend... My gut instinct is it's the latter, but I suspect it's a little bit of both, because I don't think the skill of persuasion is one that everyone has. And it is probably a learned skill to some degree, but it's not one that everyone has. So I'm a little bit in the former camp, but that not for a minute do I think I can persuade anyone of anything. And I don't think that person exists. So you have to, on a certain respect, do the latter as well, where you are trying to marry up your skills with someone who wants to be taken down that journey. Are you on mute there, Jack?
You're on mute there, Jack. The old classic.
It's okay, we'll edit that. That's a good answer, Killian. A very, very good answer. And by that answer, you could definitely work in sales. One of the things you're talking about there when it comes to persuasion, I think for us, before you try and persuade, or if that's the route that you're going to go down, we know that knowledge is key. So when it comes to you in the courtroom and finding out as much information as possible, or maybe an element of that happens before, what kind of questions do you ask to get the relevant information, and how do you ask questions?
So typically, for any case that comes my way, there will be a huge amount of information that will be deposited with me. And a big part of my job is filtering out that information. So normally it's a lot of it is before me already. And then in the actual in event itself, when a barrister is cross-examining, there is often said that the golden rule of cross-examination is never ask a question you don't already know the answer to. So actually, I will normally already know, and I'm trying to get the witness to concede the point. And if they don't give me the answer I want, I can take them, keep going down the path to show them the information that tells them that the answer I wanted is the correct one. So the exercise of cross-examination is not a sincere journey of discovery for me. It's quite the opposite. It's about demonstrating to the decision maker through the cross-examination why I'm right.
That's so fascinating. And I think that's kind of that there are definitely some similarities in sales. So if you're taking somebody down that path and they're not giving you the answer that you want, what kind of tactics can you bring to the table, or what kind of skills can you bring to dig a bit deeper to get them to open up?
So there will be times when I know there is no way I'm going to convince someone of something through cross-examination, and oftentimes, you know, and that's a little bit like having a good case and cutting out your bad points. There are certain things you can't demonstrate, but there will be certain things which are objectively verifiable, and the person will have to concede it. And what you do in those circumstances is you keep testing them and going down and giving them reasonable proposition after reasonable proposition to take them down the path. And the tactic, the way it was explained to me, is you walk them down the plank, and essentially it's like walking towards that and giving them reasonable propositions. And they either have to do one of two things. I have to either see that what you're saying is so reasonable, they can't disagree with you. Or if they do disagree with you, it's as effective because they are rejecting propositions which are just so objectively correct that they look like a fool. And actually, I don't need them to concede it, because the exercise isn't about convincing the person I'm asking questions. It's about demonstrating to the person observing, the decision maker, that what I'm doing is correct. So if they start giving me daft answers, it's actually to my benefit, because it tells the decision maker, oh, I'm probably not going to believe what they're saying.
And I suppose on that, what if someone is tactically vague, or there's just enough avoidance to seemingly answer the question, but it's not quite what you're looking for? What tactics do you employ then to get clarity?
Well, that's one of the great joys of cross-examination, that ultimately a witness can't avoid the glare and focus of a barrister, provided the barrister knows what they're doing. Because ultimately, you can force a witness to answer a question. They are there to answer the questions. It's not within their discretion not to answer. So they have to engage with it. And one of my common responses is, thank you for that answer. What's the answer to my question now? And you'll just drill them down until they really have to engage with what you're putting to them.
Wow. I wish I could be as direct as you can be. You've got a similar versions of that where we would say, it's a great question. It's the great answer. It's not quite what I was looking for. But if I could say it your way, I'd probably get a lot further, a lot quicker. Just something that's come up that I was interested in just in your own journey. So me and Jack are big on psychology and the role of biases and how that plays a role. I imagine in your work, it's crucial to be as objective as possible. But then what role did that play in your career in terms of having to snap yourself out of any biases or judgment you were making, or, you know, I quite like this person, or how has that all played a role and how have you kept discipline?
So the reason I do planning law is largely related to the fact that I am, generally speaking, very objective about the outcome of a case. So, you know, there are areas of law, like crime and family law, where there are very emotive subjects. And I imagine, you know, I know lawyers who do those areas of law, and it's quite subjective and it can cause a lot of turmoil. Planning, in truth, I don't really care about the outcome of the case in any personal way. I'm rarely, if ever, affected by the outcome of whether a large house builder gets planning permission to develop a site down south. It makes no difference to my life. So that's what drew me to it. The fact that I don't care about the outcome means I just think about it as the exercise of a little bit like a sale. You know, I want to get this sale through. But there's no emotional context to that, and it retains that objectivity. And oddly, it makes me better at my job, keeping that objectivity, I think, rather than if I was subjectively and emotionally engaged. Actually, I'd go one step further. Those lawyers I know who are very subjective, they can be very motivated. So that can be a great source of motivation for them, that they're so personally invested in the outcome. But rarely are they very good at their job, because they don't have that ability to forensically stand back and think, okay, well, how will someone else think about this? And retain that objective lens. There's an anecdote which there's an exercise that they do with children, which is they bring children into a room, and in the room there's a box. Now inside the box there are green chocolates, so green Smarties. But on the label of the box, it says blue Smarties. So you say to the child, what's inside the box? Before they've looked inside, they'll say blue Smarties. You then let them look inside. They see green Smarties. And you then say, okay, someone else is coming in. What will they think is in the box? And children will say green Smarties, because they won't track objectively how they've got to the answer that they've reached. So you kind of need to retain that objective lens to understand how you've got to the position of green Smarties, so that you can take someone else along that route.
We call it in sales the attachment to outcome, which goes back to Buddha and things like that. That's quite interesting, like the feeling that you have towards it. But surely, and I might get a bit deep with this question, Killian, but in terms of like ego, then like at times there must have been situations where, or I know that you're one of the best in the country, so maybe you haven't lost, but situations that don't go your way, and rejection, like, or a loss or something might not go your way. A rejection might feel like a personal attack in some sense. How do you deal with those in that moment, and how do you kind of combat that?
Yeah, so I'll, like many barristers, I'll concede that I have a huge ego. Certainly at the outset of my career, the losses, both the wins and the losses, I would take as a direct consequence of my involvement. But as I've got older and a little bit wiser about the job, I realize actually I'm a cog in the machine. And I don't I acknowledge that I do make a difference to the case, but I'm only one element of that. And as I said, you know, having a good case is an important component of being good at persuasion. A little bit like having a good product is key. So I acknowledge that I play a part, but I don't try not to let the losses and the wins go to my head.
Okay, good answer. One of the things you said earlier was quite interesting. Like you had this path where you could go to be a barrister or you could be a film producer. And one of the things that drew you to being a barrister was the performance side. Now, as we said at the start, like the four characters we think of in sales is the barrister, the idiot, the therapist, but also the actor, somebody that can perform, think on their feet. So talk to me about the performance side of being a barrister. For me, I thought it was somebody incredibly clever that asks brilliant questions and makes people look like idiots. But obviously that there is that performance element. What does that look like in your role?
So I you know, you are standing up in court or in venues around the country, oftentimes in front of, you know, there can sometimes be, you know, 50 people and whatnot, and you have to then present your argument, oftentimes in a hostile environment. You know, I will go a lot of times to venues where they're full of local residents who are hating the scheme I'm promoting, and they will be sort of cheering at me for the duration of the week. And I have to sort of perform in that environment and persuade in that sort of environment. And, you know, that just the notion of getting up and presenting something to a group of people, there's an element of performance there, and you've got to have timing, and you've got to be able to read your room and read your audience. So that aspect of it, I'd say there's a performance aspect.
And another thing you mentioned before that I wanted to come back to was around this idea of adjusting based on the decision maker. So if you've got someone in front of you, you think, right, there's an adjustment that needs to take place here based on this decision maker. What are those things that you're looking for, those factors that you're looking for? Is it the personality type? Is it evidence of things they've done before? What are the things that you're looking for that mean that you have to adjust?
Yeah, so what we will typically do as a team is anytime we are told who our decision maker is, we will normally research what they have been doing for the last 2-3 years, what their level of experience is, what we'll look at their previous decisions, and I'll often read them just to get a feel of this is how they've tended to deal with these sorts of issues, and ask around, because normally someone will have been before them before, and just get a sense as to who they are. And that will inform your judgment. But then equally, when you're actually there and you're looking in the whites of their eyes, a little bit like a salesperson, you're just from human to human, your job is to get the message across to them. And you're constantly reading them. You know, it's said about barristers, you should always be watching the judge's pen. You know, if they're not writing the point down, you can take it as read that it's not a point that they are interested in. So you're just always watching their body language and just reading them, which is, that's probably the skill which is probably inherent to someone who's good at persuasion, because you don't really get taught that. It's a bit like a good poker player or a good salesperson. It's just the ability to sort of respond to what the little information someone is giving you.
So it sounds like you're looking for reads in real time as well. It's not just about the research you've done before. It's about responding in real time.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. I'm interested, you know, obviously, if this is too personal, you don't have to answer. But in terms of the things that you've learned from the work that you've done, is there any of those skills that you take into real life as well, in terms of like personal relationships, meeting new people, any of those skills that you take into your own life?
Yes. So before I got into the job, I remember people would say to me, you're bright, but you don't think like a lawyer. And I was like, I don't know what that means. And the job does rewire your brain somewhat, because you're constantly thinking about life in an objective way. So, you know, people, when they do argue with me in personal life, I wouldn't ever raise my voice, and I'd always be looking for this solution and whatnot. But then equally, it can be infuriating, because I'm like, well, here's my 5 points as to why you're wrong. And, you know, And so I think that you're constantly doing that objective lens of trying to analyze a problem to find a solution.
So it sounds like in situations of conflict, you've over time managed to you've managed to remove any kind of emotion in any time of conflict or any situation. How that's very difficult, and as we know with the inner chimp, it can take over and we can wind down the window in a traffic jam and stick your middle finger up. But it sounds like you've tried to, I know that you've kind of crafted this skill over time. Is there anything that's helped you improve that?
I think that these are skills that you learn by necessity, to be honest. Just going out there and constantly doing case after case after case, it does just make you battle weary. And one thing I've noted is that when I have a little bit of time away from the courtroom environment, which I'm talking 6 weeks away, where I might be doing less advocacy, so less in court work, and I come back, I can feel myself being not as sharp. So just always doing it is the secret, and just always being in that environment of having to be objective, having to be reasonable, because one of the tricks of cross-examination is it is a battle between you and the person you're cross-examining as to who can seem more reasonable at the end of that exchange. So you are forced to not be emotional and not be difficult and whatnot.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. One of the things I've kind of picked up on through this conversation, and we say it all the time, is like a good salesperson, one of the things that you struggle to teach is tonality. Whereas you speak clearly and you come across well, like if you were cold calling me, Killian, I'd give you 30 seconds, 1,000,000%. Talk to me about tonality. Like, do you think it's something that can be taught? If it is, how do you improve that? Like, when you're talking, especially in like a courtroom setting, what are you thinking about the way that you present yourself for that performance mode?
Yeah. So I remember when my first interview for becoming a barrister, I was walking from London Euston Station to the Chambers, and I had a 20-minute walk there, and I had a very Scouse accent at the time, which you might hear a little bit now. It's softened over time, but it was quite Scouse at the time. And I recall on the walk there, I was pretending to speak on the phone, practicing a voice which I thought was more commensurate with what a barrister should sound like a received pronunciation, like someone who would read the news. And I was practicing this voice with a view of, I'm going to go into this interview and speak like what I think a barrister should sound like. And just before I walked in, so I'd got this voice and I'd got myself into the mode. And just before I walked in, I thought, no, if I'm going to fail, I'm going to fail on my own terms. And I reverted to my actual voice in the interview. Didn't get the interview, but I did actually take from that being authentic is important. And I do think that's a key component of being persuasive, and you can sense it when someone's being authentic with you. So just being yourself is important. Now, obviously, you need to be articulate, and having a good diction never hurts. But ultimately, I think being authentic is paramount to whatever tone you want to aspire to.
If we stick on somewhat on that of the performative nature, so you know, there's a tone of voice that you're going to speak in, you're going to come across as probably a slightly different personality type than you are at home, unless you do go around challenging everyone all day. But what's the sort of the pre-performance ritual to get you in the zone? You know, you've had Sunday off, and then you come in on a Monday and it's high stakes. How do you get yourself in the zone for what you're about to do?
In a sense, you're never really out of that zone, if I was doing, for example, a short performance, you might gear yourself up mentally, but I will do a whole week of a case. And that is really important, that, you know, you will be doing that case 9:30 until 5:30 each day. That's when you're in that arena. That will be for 5 days. So you don't have the moment where, you know, before yourself, you go in, you're listening to the Rocky theme tune or whatever it is to gear yourself up to it. You just have to sort of stay in that mindset. It's actually getting out of the mindset is the trick. That's the bit that's hard. It's not getting it psyched up for it. It's learning how to unwind is the secret.
And we might be getting in the weeds a bit here, but in terms of the types of questions that you could ask someone, so we know that a why question, for instance, would maybe be a bit triggering for people. You know, what did you do on the weekend? How was it? Why did you do it? Suddenly, oh God, that feels like I'm being attacked. What's the role between different types of questions and where do you typically employ them?
So there are two types of questions that barristers will ask. There are leading questions and there are non-leading questions. You might be familiar with these two distinctions, but it's the paramount distinction that between barristers, because if a witness is on your side, you ask non-leading questions, and that's a question that doesn't suggest the answer. So if I said to you, what if anything did you do this weekend? And the if anything is, I'm not even suggesting you did anything. So I'm giving you no, you've got full breadth to answer it. Now that's how you'd ask a question of someone who's on your side, because you're not meant to be suggesting the answer to them, to the idea being they give the answer independent of you. If you're asking someone who's not on your side, so someone on the other side, you ask a leading question, that's a question which suggests the answer. And for example, I'd say, you did this at the weekend, you went ice skating, didn't you? So that would be typically the distinction. And if the witness, you will recall I said earlier, you never ask a question that you don't know the answer to. That's because you're always suggesting the answer to them in cross-examination.
Can you hit a point of visible cognitive strain after you've hit some with a few of those in a row, they feel maybe a bit backed into a corner and the answers start to slow down, there's a bit more debate, it's not as free flowing. Is there a risk to any of those styles of questioning?
Sometimes, but I think, you know, as a cross-examination goes on, normally you have the early battles and they sort of start to realize that once you've knocked them down a peg or two, that's when, because there were two good ways to start a cross-examination. The first is you get them into a very agreeable mood. So you start asking them a whole series of questions of which you know that they can't reasonably say no to. So they just get into the habit of saying yes, yes, yes to you. And then you start hitting them with the more controversial things. And they've already got engendered into that attitude of saying yes to you. That's option one. Option two is you hit them really hard with something really difficult right away. So they're overwhelmed and they're embarrassed as well, because you've hit them with something that they probably, something they've said in their evidence that they were daft to have said. And then they're sort of weakened. And then you just keep hitting them and hitting them.
I love this. I want to stick on this for a bit, Killeen, because this is really our bread and butter. It sounds like the leading and non-leading questions, it sounds for leading questions, a lot of them are closed. So like the answers are yes or no. Are there any times where it feels more appropriate or it leads more to a bit more of an open question with leading questions?
Yeah. So sometimes, sometimes I will say to a witness, you know, if I'll put them to a series of propositions and they'll say no, and I'll be left thinking, okay, well, I have no idea how you get to that position. Can you help me? And I'm trying to expose them as saying that you're being daft now. Help me with this. And then they are in the vacuum that they have to join points A and B, which I've been saying there isn't a connection. So you know, they say the rule of cross-examination is, you know, always ask a leading question. Once you get good at it, you can learn to deviate from that and you can ask those open questions and whatnot. And that can sometimes be even more effective when you say, well, I'm clueless now how you get to that conclusion. Can you help me?
I don't think you meant to, Killeen, but you've just introduced our third character, the idiot. It's one of our favourite... No, but how did you get to that point? It's one of our favorites on calls would be like, sorry, I'm a bit lost, what do you mean? And it's that the opportunity to dig deep. So since we've had the lawyer, the idiot and the actor in the room so far, I'm going to see if there's any, the fourth character is the therapist, to kind of allow empathy, to get them to open up, to make them feel heard and to ask questions in a therapeutic style. This might lead nicely onto questions when they're on your side. Are there any times where you think the therapist might come into play when cross-examining it?
Insofar as you're judging your decision maker, in that respect, I'd imagine. Funnily enough, when you said here are the four characters and you said actor, barrister, and idiot and therapist, I thought, well, the first three, I've been them at various points in my life. The therapist is the least one of what I could relate to. So probably not to a great extent, but to the extent of which I'm trying to gauge ultimately, whilst the exchange is between me and the person I'm cross-examining, it is all for the benefit of the person over there. And I'm constantly having to just gauge, are they registering this? Is this landing with them? Someone said you've got to score while the referee's watching.
And what's the, we talked a bit about your own bias before in terms of, you know, your ability to be objective and not emotionally involved. How would you navigate your opposition's biases? So obviously, regardless of evidence, people come with their own built-in biases, their own, perhaps if it's housing developers, or, you know, there's ego involved. So there's going to be, yeah, I might have said that, but, or I didn't mean it because. And how do you navigate just the human bias and the evidence and create something that's kind of a tangible argument between what's fact and what's just human nature?
So there's cut out your bad points. Is that was one of the principles I said that you need to be good at to be persuasive. There will be undoubtedly mistakes and things that people make along the way that you're cross-examining. You focus on the ones that are material and actually are of some substance, because, you know, I could spend all day picking flaws in someone's evidence, but you've always got to say, well, so what? You know, why is it important that they've made that error to the decision ultimately that the decision maker's got to make? So kind of keeping your eye on the prize. The fact that they come to the table with a bias, it doesn't interest me. It's how is that bias relevant to the goal of what I want to achieve? So I'll give you an example. I recently did a case where it was clear that I was acting in this instance for Manchester City Council, and we were successful in the appeal. But they wanted to knock down Shute Hill interchange and put in a high rise building. What became clear is that the way it had been designed is from the outset of, well, we want to make as much money as we can. How it looks is a secondary consideration. Now, that was their bias. Now, it was exposing that, and it was that we could show along the process of which they developed the site, they hadn't factored in good suggestions and instead had picked the cheaper option along the way. And when we got the decision we won, the inspector, the decision maker, said it is clear that that's what's happened. So it was exposing that bias was actually relevant in that instance.
So just to be clear on that, so it was that there was huge commercial gain, but they'd not thought about the aesthetic, like it was going to be an ugly eyesore. What was the...
Correct. They had sacrificed aesthetic improvements for the sake of money, because they, you know, you can make a building look better, but it all comes at cost. And they had favoured the cheaper options rather than picking good aesthetics, such that the scheme they wanted to build looked quite poor.
And is that, this is maybe a bit of a challenging question, is there a one day you've done that and won that argument, and then next week you're on the other side, you've got to make the opposite argument?
Or next day sometimes, Zach. We are guns for hire, ultimately, barristers. So, you know, we've got a rule which is called the cab rank rule, which basically, like a cab rank, we have to say yes to the next case, irrespective of our bias. So whether I believe or disbelieve a position, I have to take it on.
So then I suppose how do you view your purpose there? Is it I have to win, or is it I just have to make a compelling argument, and regardless if you believe it, it doesn't matter as long as I've made my argument?
Yes, sort of the latter. I would say they, you know, said that no man can serve two masters, but a barrister is sort of the exception to that, because I'm on the one hand serving the benefit of my client. I want to get the outcome they desire, but equally I'm there in service of the court, and my job is to facilitate the representation of my clients and present that, but whilst serving the court and making sure that the process is fair. So yeah, ultimately my job is to be objective and present their cases in the best possible way.
I liked what you were saying earlier about being a cog in the machine. I think it's there's a hat that you put on and you become the barrister. And then I'm sure when you get home at night, you take that hat off and you're no longer like in the same sense that like I've heard stories about policemen, police women. They'll when they get in, they'll take off a coat and it'll be like, right, I'm snapping back in. And that allows you that freedom. And the best salespeople I see are consistent. They're not emotionally attached and they are just in that moment. And then when they leave, they're kind of far removed from the highs and the lows of what's going on.
Yeah, I think because Zach was like, how do you gear up for it? I was saying earlier, I think actually the trick is getting out of that mindset, because you have to spend a lot more of your time in that headspace of being good at that persuasion than out of it, so to speak. Mm. So it's being able to do a long day and at the end of it, finding those ways of removing yourself, which, you know, it's everyone's got their own knacks, you know, whether it's having a drink, spending time with friends, you know, playing instruments, having a hobby, or whatever it is. But finding those tricks is essential.
Killian, I've loved this chat because I feel like there's so much. If you're ever in need of a job, not that you ever will be, but we're always hiring salespeople. I'll ask you one last question before I let you go. If I was to give you a room of 10 salespeople new to the job, they've never done it in their life, and it's your job to train them up and give them one skill, what would you do? Where would you start?
Might be a cheap answer to say, sell me this pen. I think I would take them through that the knowing your audience point. I do think that is absolutely key. I think if you don't know that, you don't know how to even approach the problem of how do you persuade someone. You've got to go, well, who am I persuading? That's, and figuring out how you get to that position of understanding that, I think is probably the first skill I would be trying to teach anyone, because you can't persuade someone else, you know, how you go about doing that.
Mm. We talk about it all the time with like personas. If I'm going to be calling CEOs, what are they more likely to respond to? What are their personality types? How do they like to be spoken to? What don't they like? Things like that. Killian, thank you so much for joining us. A brilliant conversation. Lots of good takeaways there for people working in sales. And if you're ever looking for a barrister, Mr. Killian Garvey is the person to knock on his door. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Cheers, chaps.